Okay, hello and welcome everybody to today's talk. I think we can safely say we can begin to start sometime soon now on what is the next thing on the war on terror, which we all want to find out. It's brilliant to see so many faces here today, I have to say. Thank you all for coming down, and hopefully you'll go away with being able to take away what we can learn next about this situation that we find ourselves in. Myself will be chairing the talk. My name is Hazara Begum, and first of all, we have Alex Snowden, who is a long-term activist for Stop the War Coalition and has plenty to say. So take it away, Alex.
Okay, thank you, Hazara. First of all, my apologies from passing on apologies from Lindsay German, who's the national convener or Stop the War, who's unfortunately ill. She just let us know at pretty short notice that she wouldn't be able to make it up here. She's spoken at Newcastle University before, and I know she was looking forward to visiting again. So I'm stepping in and providing some context in terms of the war on terror, the last 11 years really, the past, present and future of the current period that the current period that we're in. And I want to start by saying something about the American presidential election. There's a very good column in today's Guardian by Seamus Milne, who's a long-standing critic, very fierce critic of American foreign policy and of American imperialism. And he writes about the debate on Monday night between Mitt Romney, the Republican challenger, and President Obama. And the debate focused on foreign policy. And he says that whatever the personal views of the politician at the top, the US empire is a system, not a policy, underpinned by corporate and military interests. And whoever runs Washington heads a global empire, so that American politics affect people's lives in every part of the world, often as a matter of life and death. And I think that since September 2001, that has been borne out in fairly obvious and graphic ways, with a huge amount of suffering, in particular in Iraq and Afghanistan. But I want to say a little bit this evening about the broader context of that as well. And also, Seamus Milne noted that for most of Monday night's candidates' TV debate, it was hard to put a credit card between them. So while most people around the world would prefer not to see Romney elected, that is not because of any great enthusiasm for the foreign policies of Barack Obama. There's been a huge amount of disappointment since the kind of Obama mania a few years ago when he was elected. There's been a great deal of disappointment in the way that things have worked out. And I think a lot of that goes back to what I started with there about being a system underpinned by corporate and military interests, regardless of the politician at the top. So I want to say a little bit about how things have developed, and I think there has been far more continuity in the last 4 years, far more continuity with the Obama administration than there has been change from the George W. Bush era. So the election coming up in 2 weeks, 6th of November, and Obama has actually mocked and derided Romney for having a foreign policy, came out with a line about having a foreign policy straight out of the 1980s. And one of the reasons for saying that is that Romney once referred to Russia as currently being America's number one kind of threat and enemy, which was, I think, the main source of Obama's comment. The problem is that Obama's policy is very much, Obama's approach, kind of very much still rooted in the politics of the first decade of this century. And he's basically continued that with a few modifications. The era that opened up in September 2001 with the very belligerent and aggressive response to the appalling terrorist atrocities in New York, with the invasion of Afghanistan 1 month later, October 2001, then leading on to the invasion and occupation of Iraq in 2003, that era is very much the one that we're still living in. The war on terror, sometimes it's sometimes said to be more appropriate to describe it as a war of terror. That is continuing. There's the same ideas. The US is still promoted as a champion of freedom, taking on rogue states, taking on Islamist terror networks, to liberate oppressed people in faraway countries. This is the positive way in which it's promoted. Now, I think the real motivations have always been different. They were different in 2001, they're different now. The US very much has to assert its strength and its superiority in the world, and particularly in relation to very economically important areas and politically important areas in the Middle East and in Western Asia, Afghanistan and Pakistan, asserts its superiority and its strength in those areas of the globe. And so there are economic and political factors driving what we've seen over the last decade or so. It's not really about freedom, it's not really about democracy. And I think an important part of the background to this is that actually, although America's seen as the last great superpower and is kind of dominating the world, actually it has had relative economic decline. Compared with many of its competitors, it's had economic difficulties, and it's not its share of kind of global GDP, global wealth, is not what it used to be. In particular, it perceives China as a kind of rising challenge and as a rising economic threat. But it still dominates militarily. Seamus Mill made the point in his article that if you look at the figures on military spending, it outspends the next 20 powers put together. It's absolutely massive, the amount of money that they spend. Incidentally, a majority of American people want military spending to be cut. It's not the case that the Romney-Obama debate and the terms of that debate reflect American public opinion. The majority of American people actually think that the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, both of those countries, were a mistake. The majority think that it would be wrong to directly arm the Syrian rebels, and they struggled to get public support a year or so ago to bomb Libya, and same in this country. So the background is actually some long-term sort of economic decline, and it compensates for that through its military dominance. Now, one part of that is military spending. Another thing is people often forget that there are American military bases just about everywhere, and particularly in the Middle East and parts of Asia. It has a network of bases that no other country can even begin to compete with, and that's an important part of its military domination. There's also the fact, as Kyle is going to talk about in his talk, there's a kind of geographical extension of the war over the last few years into countries like Pakistan, Somalia, and Yemen because of drone warfare. The use of drone warfare, which we'll be hearing more about later, means that actually in some ways the war on terror has expanded over the last 3 or 4 years and creating more instability, creating greater problems. And so much of what America has done and supported by its allies, including the UK, has actually come from weakness, not simply from strength. Military power is its greatest asset in the context of struggling in other ways. And there's a number of elements to this. I just want to quickly run through, I think, the different elements of the war on terror. People always focus quite reasonably on Iraq and Afghanistan, and there were massive demonstrations against the war in Iraq. That's one part of it, but also the funding, the support, the very close ties with Israel, which acts as a kind of watchdog for American imperialism in the Middle East. The threats and the sanctions against a number of countries, currently sanctions imposed on Iran, which are taking a brutal toll on the Iranian people. Don't affect the people at the top, they most affect ordinary Iranians. The fact that they still rely on loyal allies in the region, Saudi Arabia most importantly, an absolutely brutal and repressive state. The American links, and indeed the British links with Saudi Arabia, completely undermine all of that rhetoric of fighting for human rights, of wars for liberation. And until the fall of Mubarak, until the Egyptian Revolution brought Mubarak down a year or so ago now, last February, until then, Egypt was an absolutely crucial ally for the West as well. The use of rendition and torture, Guantanamo Bay. Obama promised that Guantanamo Bay would close. It still hasn't closed. It's still being used. The erosion of civil liberties, the increase of a kind of surveillance state that has gone hand in hand with the wars. And I think finally, and very importantly, the growth in the demonisation of Muslims, the growth in Islamophobia, which has been the ideological accompaniment of the last 10 or 11 years of the war on terror. That's a very important component of this. So just final couple of points I want to make is that I think the things I've just outlined there have largely remained true since Obama's inauguration. Good news is that there was finally the withdrawal from Iraq. That was largely born of the fact that that war was an utter disaster, even on their own terms. And there was massive opposition globally to that war. And actually, it's a reminder that the Americans certainly haven't got everything their own way. Far from it. Iraq and Afghanistan have been disasters. That's a significant thing. I think also a very significant development in the last 2 years is starting in December 2010, there's been a wave of popular uprisings, the Arab Spring, the Arab Revolutions, that have shaken American influence in the region. And they found a number of ways of fighting back against that, particularly the bombing of Libya as a way of getting into the Arab revolutionary movements, and also the support of the Saudis in crushing the Bahraini opposition movement in brutal fashion. But that the Arab Spring gives us hope. And I think also the anti-war movements globally, including a massive demonstration on February the 15th in London, February the 15th, 2003, when 1 to 2 million people demonstrated, millions more around the world, those movements have shaken US power, US hegemony in the world. So where are we now? Just finish with this. I think that in some ways America and its allies, including Britain, are weaker than they were in 2001. They often can't intervene overtly, directly in countries like they would like. I think they would like to do that in Syria, just like they did in Libya. They're stopped from doing that for a number of reasons, the kind of weaknesses that they have. The fact they can't build a global alliance. Russia and China, for example, won't support a UN resolution to attack Syria. But they are finding more covert means to intervene. This is extremely important. There's the very close ties they've got with Israel, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and so on. There's the fact that they still have the military bases everywhere. There's been no reduction in that. Hugely wasteful spending on arms. The fact they are involved in arming sections of the movement in Syria. I mean, they arm the people who they can do business with. They don't arm everyone. They try to buy off parts of the popular movement in Syria and work with them for what they see the Syrian regime as something they want to remove, and they'll help sections of the movement within the country in doing that. And also I think the sanctions on Iran, which are absolutely devastating. And sanctions can be a prelude to war. Sanctions can be a lead up to war. They're not some kind of healthy, positive alternative to war. The sanctions on Iraq preceded the war in Iraq. So we have to remember that, and we have to be absolutely vigilant about that. So what we can do in the future, because what will happen is partly shaped by us. Two things. One is the anti-war movement in this country and elsewhere in the West. We have to oppose our own government. Our own government, whether it was the Blair government, the Brown government, the Cameron government, the British government is an absolute special friend, a loyal ally, special relationship, whatever phrase is used, absolutely tied to the US and plays an important part in that. But the other thing is the mobilisations in the Arab world and in countries like Iran and Pakistan. There's been some big demonstrations in the last couple of weeks in Pakistan around the use of drones. That is important too. And they haven't been able to get their own way all the time. I think they would have invaded or attacked in some way Iran well before now if it wasn't for a combination of popular movements in this section of the world and popular movements in the Arab world. So what we do does make a difference, even if it doesn't always feel like it. And so that narrow gap between Obama and Romney in the election debate and in the election coming up, we shouldn't allow that to be the terms of debate. We need to broaden that debate, and we need to kind of organise and mobilise around a very different set of values and a different set of priorities. We have to have that critique that we're outlining today of what's going wrong, and also have a sense that things can be done differently. When you think of what the enormous wasteful spending on arms and on the wars could be spent on, what that, fund education, not war, was one of the demands that some of us raised last weekend on the massive anti-cuts demonstration. Cut Trident. Is that a Trident replacement fund public services. These are the sort of things that I think we need to start to organise around. So I'll finish on that note. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alex. I think you've covered so many of the aspects there. It's just a sea of factors. Like, for example, even Iran now, what are they being hit with? Sanctions, because if they're the country, who's next to be even hit with, you know, with possibly World War III, God forbid. And other than that, because Alex has touched upon so many points, I'd like you all to save what reasoning you have to talk about it for the question and answer as well. I mean, I know I could go off on that as well, but we've got Kyle here, which I'm sure you all are aware of, for those who do actually study here. Come on down, Kyle, come on. An actual international politics tutor. So I'm sure he has a lot of other interesting things to say.
Okay, I do have slides that will hopefully, once the projector comes back on at some point. I'd want to start, though, by thanking Nick and everyone for the invitation to come and speak here this evening. And the brief presentation that I am going to be giving is based on a book project that I've been working on now for, I'm embarrassed to say this, about 4 years, which examines the cultural politics of assassination and targeted killing. And this has required that I analyze the geographical imaginations, the technical rationalizations, and legal reasoning underpinning these practices historically, as well as in the wars of contemporary counterinsurgency. And we're still waiting. So I'm going to begin by laying out a working definition for targeted killing. And then I'll outline some problems that I see with current treatments of the practice, in order to introduce six theses for further discussion. There are only six, not 95, and that's basically due to the age of austerity and government cutbacks. A Reformation joke for some of you out there. Okay, so targeted killing can be defined as the intentional selection, targeting an execution of an individual who's not held in physical custody, so you don't have control over them, by a state for military, political, or security purposes. It's a type of assassination event that I argue has been enabled by the logics of contemporary counterinsurgency, reconfigurations in the structures of advanced militaries to better resemble logics that are driven by markets, and technological developments that now provide the capability to survey, to target, and exterminate specific individuals from afar in real time. Now, to date, much media attention has been devoted to the who, where, what, why, and how of these acts of killing, at the expense of examining how these are socially embedded. They don't appear from outer space. They're a social practice, and as a social practice, they're subject to relations of power. Moreover, most treatments ignore the broader political cultural context in which targeted killing is taking place. And even when showing an interest in doing so, there tends to be a tendency to relate what politics is to formal politics. It's stuff that Obama does or stuff that takes place in Parliament. But I think such formalism leads to important power dynamics being overlooked. And it provokes us to think about what targeted killing as a phenomenon can tell us about contemporary political violence, about the shape of global order, and the security cultures that are underpinning all of them. So to this end, I want to introduce six theses with regards to targeted killing. And the central argument that I'm going to present, that's kind of running through all of them, is that target killing is productive of broader power relations, broader cultural dispositions, and geographical imaginations that are constitutive of the Western-led global counterinsurgency campaign. Now, by no means what I'm talking about here is exhaustive. There are far more things that we could bring up. But their purpose today is to underscore key elements of targeted killing that themselves might be targets to affect political transformation. And that's how I'm going to end. They're not necessarily particularly detailed, but they're getting us to think about, if we think of this culturally, if we think of this more broadly, what becomes some of the areas that we might want to contest? So, thesis number one. Targeted killing reveals multiple governing logics at work. So my sense is that targeted killing is a nodal point through which relations of domination, submission, and resistance that are formed by legal power, micro power that attempts to shape the conduct of individuals, macro forms of power that attempt to shape populations, and the desire for control circulate. These are more important to enabling the practice than any one individual or specific regime, and I think this is something that Alex brought up in his presentation. Individuals who have been targeted have been determined to be located beyond the forms of legitimate political articulation that constitute contemporary politics. They're seen as deviant in some way. They're identified by a profile of danger that's calculated based on perceptions of race, religion, gender, and nationality that are then married to notions of political affiliation, capabilities, and intent. Extermination invokes the spectacle of public punishment, the ordering conformity of disciplinary norms, the way in which we try and get people to behave within certain tolerable bandwidths, the theology of killing to make life live, and the desire expressed through mechanisms of control to immediately locate, position, and track persons of interest across a governmental environment that is now being conceived of on a planetary scale. These logics resonate and they recombine throughout the projects of counterinsurgency. Yet the resiliency of existing networks of opposition and ongoing micro-resistances to Western governance means that targeted killing also encapsulates the very failure of these forms of governmental power to deliver what they promise. Imperial glory, compliant bodies, governable populations, or security through the control of flows across territories. Targeted killing does not deter. Targeted killing does not even really disrupt what it's supposed to disrupt. Its counterproductiveness is born of a frustration and anxiety over the failure of global counterinsurgency to successfully impose the preferred global order on what the U.S. Department of Defense refers to as ungoverned areas. Thesis number two.
Oh, can you tell us about that map?
Oh, yes, this is a reconfiguration of what was called the Pentagon's new map, which was an article written by a guy called Thomas Barnett, who is currently at the U.S. Naval College in Rhode Island, and he also claims to have been a top Pentagon advisor. And essentially his argument is that the way that the U.S. military looks at the world at the moment is that the region inside the dotted line is known as the non-integrating gap. That's the problem area. That's the area you need to be nervous about. And everything else is known as the functioning core. And so the idea is to shrink that non-integrating gap. And of course, if you look closely and you think of areas in which there have been military deployments over the past two decades, a lot of them have tended to be along that dotted line, particularly in the Middle East and Southeastern Europe. So the second thesis. Targeted killing is a form of lawfare. And this means that the law is deployed in tandem with other tactics in the hopes of achieving particular objectives. So framed as a preemptive strike against imminent threats, or more controversially, right, those with the capabilities to pose a threat, it's been identified, targeted killing, as an appropriate tactical response to the strategic problem of facing an adversary with dangerous intentions who supposedly cannot be deterred. So officially, the goals of targeted killing are not punishment, they're not retribution, or deterrence, but prevention. And prevention within a conflict that is represented as being without precedent. This framing then takes targeted killing outside of the areas of international human rights law, where one might be able to make an argument that it indeed constitutes extrajudicial killing. and places it squarely within the laws of war, the right to war, as well as right conduct in war. But rather than operate through a disregard for the law, targeted killing as a form of lawfare is sustained through the mobilization of legal interpretations of principles like imminence, proportionality, combatant status, name targeting, and last resort in the contemporary security environment that take advantage of the inherent ambiguities of international law. So I think the challenge is not that targeted killing violates the law at first principles, although you could make that argument, but rather that it's able to work through existing legal frameworks and expand the parameters of permissible conduct. So too often, and this is something that I fall prey to myself, in critiquing the practices that are a part of contemporary counterinsurgency, we operate under the assumption that the actions are indisputably in direct violation of the law. And I think the challenge is that a credible, and though not necessarily convincing, legal defense for these practices can be provided in most cases, and targeted killing is no exception here. So contrary to perceptions of the limiting power of the legal realm, that somehow the law and the laws of war constrain the state, the excesses of the national security state can be enabled rather than constrained through the practices of lawfare. Thesis number three. Targeted killing is a visual practice. While the centrality of vision to practices of power has been identified by the likes of Michel Foucault and Edward Said, an anthropologist named Alan Feldman, who did a lot of field work in Northern Ireland, has suggested that compulsory visibility, and I'm quoting here, is the rationality of state counterinsurgency. So targeted killing itself is therefore predicated on forms of visual surveillance that authorize forms of bodily intervention. You have to see first in order to then try and intervene. Targets have to be visually identified, they have to be confirmed, they have to be tracked and positioned relative to other people and material objects in the complex spaces of everyday activity. Now, claims to the precise and discriminatory nature of the practice all rest on a consensus about the veracity of the surveillance produced through the technologically enhanced vision enabled by drones. And these, in turn, are reliant on specific ways of seeing, or what is also referred to in academic literature as a scopic regime. Now, a scopic regime refers to the cultural means, techniques, and norms for viewing the visual field that allow us to see some things quite easily and to recognize them as certain things, and others that we don't recognize or are unable to see. So the scopic regime that operationalizes targeted killing is one that operates under the assumption that vision, particularly through technological enhancement, through cameras, through infrared technology, can become an infallible and objective sense that captures the physical world independently of any personal perceptions that we may have of it. In other words, that this technology accurately, realistically, and without fault presents the world to us. Those who are identified, tracked, targeted, and killed are therefore positioned as indubitable recordings of what was simply there, as well as heroic feats of technoscientific production. Right? Somehow this is supposed to make us feel good that we are able to see these people from afar and kill them. So by merging human with machine, targeted killing constructs a cyborg of seeing that surveys, targets, and exterminates. Drones with advanced camera technology combine with human operators who have been made privy to other forms of surveillance and intelligence to produce an image, a picture, even a painting of the battle space within which the targeted killing will take place. The drone then shifts these processes of visual recognition into a mode of physical extermination. but the argument that those who commit targeted killing possess a detached and disembodied vision that pursues the practice with clinical precision when circumstances justify its deployment neglects the fact that vision is also a sensibility that produces feelings, some of which we may be consciously aware of and may be able to articulate, others that we can't articulate, and others that may work on the level of the subconscious. So to paraphrase John Berger, Observation on the History of the Female Nude in Western Art, the body of the targeted, in the roles of an object of surveillance, and also as a physical expression for military power, serves to flatter the one who can view. This mode of seeing without being seen produces pleasure for the viewer and can empower acts of violence. I can see you, you can't see me. I can do things to you, you can't do things to me. Similarly, the demonstration of this form of scopic power seeks to create anxiety in potential targets and wider populations about being monitored so that their preferred norms for their behavior are internalized, so that people do what you want them to do. Therefore, while ways of seeing can be used to support truth claims about the rationality and effectiveness of political violence, we can't forget that they also produce a form of pleasure that can be addictive for the one with the privilege of viewing. So thesis number 4. Targeted killing is a form of spatial management. So geographers will tell us that we can think of space as at least the four-dimensional environment, length, width, depth, and time, in which objects and events take place, and which they have a relative position and direction in relation to one another. Now, the majority of attention that's been placed on the spatial dimension of targeted killing has focused on its territorial positioning vis-a-vis practices of mapping. Right, so we see lots of things, we go on the internet, we go on the Guardian, and we'll see a map of a particular area with little kind of markers about this is where targeted killings have taken place. So the majority of attention here, the locations are dutifully recorded, and they're positioned within territorial boundaries that are linked to broader political narratives regarding counterinsurgency and regarding the importance of the nation state. Of particular interest amongst all of this has been the possibility for targeted killing to be enacted by pilots and operators located in excess of 7,000 miles away from the immediate theater of operation. So suddenly we're beginning to know about places like Creech Air Force Base in Nevada. But beyond these sort of standard territorial nation-state based locations and the distortion of time and space that happens with targeted killing, Yael Weisman draws our attention to the forms of spatial management and sovereignty that are also a key aspect of targeted killing. And primarily, he demonstrates that in contemporary counterinsurgency, it's important to denote how practices of control have extended upwards into the stratosphere as a means of managing populations and what they're doing on the ground. This development reflects broader changes in military strategy that took place over the course of the 20th century that have equated air power with dominance over a ground territory. But as Weisman notes, this has created a reliance on air-based military technologies as a means of managing problematic spaces and populations, and the enactment of a policy that the Royal Air Force refers to as control without occupation. So as a result, counterinsurgency and war fighting that's taking place in places like Israel, Palestine, for example, are increasingly taking place along a vertical axis. Okay, not just horizontal on the ground, but vertically. And what do I mean like that? Well, when attempting to provide control without occupation means that you have to have both unimpeded access and control of airspace, as well as possessing the technology to operate within this theater of operation. And you also have to ensure that your opponent doesn't. So in response, we can see the use of subterranean warfare by insurgency movements, literally going under the ground to circumvent aerial interference. And again, this is a practice that gained currency over the course of counterinsurgency wars of the 20th century, right? For example, in Vietnam. In addition, targeted killing both alters and intensifies forms of spatial management through its ability to redefine everyday places, particularly those where individuals attempt to seek sanctuary from political, economic, and social pressures. So in geography, place refers to those spaces that are invested with understandings of behavioral appropriateness, cultural expectations, and so forth, in which we act and which we imbue with certain kinds of value. Now, insurgency, in part, gains its political and emotional impact by initiating violence within public places that have been declared secure by some kind of sovereign entity. Right? This is one of the ways in which places are targeted. Targeted killing works slightly differently. It produces political and emotional impacts by transforming private sanctuary places, particularly the home, into a public theater for counterinsurgency warfare. Moreover, as a spatial incursion from afar that cannot easily be countered or avenged, or defended against, for that matter, it places the interface of violence much closer to the places of sanctuary for the enemy. In scare quotes here. So targeted killing as a practice can thus defile sacred places. And I'm not just talking about places of religious worship or mosques or things like that. People's homes are oftentimes very sacred to them. And in defiling these sacred places, the symbolic power comes not just from defiling, but from the timeless character of defiled space. As Alan Feldman notes, defiled space never goes away. When you no longer feel safe in your home, or you feel as though you have been violated in your home to a certain extent, that is no longer your home. Thus, as a tactic, targeted killing demonstrates how counterinsurgency also seeks to violate the spatial constructs that help to structure our social orders, particularly amongst victims. It's meant to disorient. So thesis number 5. Targeted killing is a form of symbolic communication. Violence is always trying to communicate something. Its tactility and its symbolism send messages to victims, perpetrators, and those who bear witness. And unlike total war, which seeks to completely eliminate an adversary, the logic of targeted killing requires survivors in order for its future-oriented effectiveness. You need people who can bear witness, who can mourn, who can remember, and most importantly, through this process, the idea is that they will learn to abide by the desires of the targeting party. Targeted killing also communicates a value judgment that's been placed on the life of the victim. While historically the identification of an assassination event, as opposed to a battlefield death or murder, served to elevate the status of the person had been killed, the identification of a targeted killing seeks to produce a very different political effect. Those who deploy the practice have exerted much effort to distance targeted killing from the negative associations that we have with assassination, particularly in terms of legal definitions. For something to count as an assassination, it must involve treachery and perfidy under the laws of war. But targeted killing is an attempt to transpose the dishonorable connotations associated with assassins onto the one who gets assassinated. So targeted killing thus becomes a means of depoliticizing the potential political and symbolic meanings, whether that's martyrdom, honor, public significance, heroism, bravery, or being identified as somebody engaged in resistance that could be cultivated from these deaths. This is done through the decontextualization of the killing from the broader conflict, by focusing attention upon a specific person. This individual is argued to be deserving of death, not just because of their potential capabilities, but also due to their perceived intentions being considered as lacking in civility. What they want to do and how they want to do it is not cricket. So being targeted is therefore an indicator that one has been primarily determined to be an illegitimate political subject rather than necessarily an important one in the role that assassination used to play. Thesis number 6. Targeted killing reflects weakness, not strength. Although it's often justified by policymakers and their apologists in terms of its effectiveness for counterinsurgency operations, I think we can see targeted killing as a symbolic gesture of frustration undertaken in the face of many counterinsurgency policy failures. Its commissioning comes not from a position of strength, but one brought on by weakness. We have the failures of three wars of what Derek Gregory has referred to as the colonial present in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Palestine. And this frustration has been compounded by the continuing inability to control the ungoverned areas of the global south. Pakistan, Somalia, and Yemen are the ones that always come up in these discussions, that are perceived in some quarters as the breeding ground for global militant movements. So the turn to targeted killing also reflects a Western hubris that technological development can solve what are primarily political challenges. But such thinking, and pardon the pun here, is short-sighted. While academic studies have shown that targeted killing is ineffective against the types of organizations that are being pursued, the possibility for negotiated political settlement is jeopardized through the destruction of base levels of trust when the conduct of war becomes personalized against members of an opposition movement. Moreover, while targeted killing may be preferred to more orthodox forms of war fighting that require troop deployments on the ground and with all the risks that that entails, there's been a lack of foresight into the long-term damage and resentment caused by the ways that targeted killing defiles everyday places, everyday ways of life, and everyday people in its theaters of operation. So, by way of some conclusions here. Oops. So what I've tried to do is show that targeted killing reflects governing logics that are shaping contemporary counterinsurgency practices. And rather than locating itself in the tradition of the exception within security, that is this notion that security allows us to step outside of the law, targeted killing is a form of lawfare that deploys the law for strategic ends. It utilizes a scopic regime that seeks to render insurgency visible in order to provide control without occupation in areas that are currently perceived as being un- or under-governed. Thus, targeted killing is a form of symbolic communication that seeks to alter the behavior of population in ways that will make them more amenable to Western governance. And it does this by attempting to impose a specific identity on those who are selected for elimination. But despite these connotations of being all-knowing and all-powerful that the practice conveys, I think it's important to keep in mind that the use of targeted killing exposes the weaknesses of the Western global counterinsurgency campaign. So what then is to be done if we look at targeted killing within this kind of very broad sense? Well, there are a few things that it brings up that flow from it. So the first is the need to listen to the voices of those who are living under the drones and to think of the ways in which their stories and what is going on the ground can be mobilized to change public attitudes. And part of this is not treating these people as victims, but treating them as active political agents who have their own kinds of desires and ways of articulating what's important to them. The second is the need to challenge the primacy of speed in contemporary society. Targeted killing operates within a framework that the military refers to as the kill chain. And what they want to do is reduce the amount of time that it takes to initiate the kill chain. And so there is this real reliance on the notion of being able to target, position, and track people in real time and then execute them as quickly as possible. But that's no different than sort of the way in which speed operates within our own lives. Faster is always considered better, right? The faster we can get information, the faster we can do things, the faster we can make decisions. So this is a broader cultural phenomenon. Third, I don't want to argue that we should abandon the legal realm, but it shouldn't be the sole focal point in terms of trying to initiate change. Fourth, contra some ideas that have been put forward, for example, by Philip Alston, who's the UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killing, summary execution, and arbitrary execution. I don't think it's a good idea if we attempt to use the footage that is produced through drone warfare and targeted killing as a way of challenging it. The argument should be that the very notion of this surveillance and the images produced, the argument should be that these are in no way accurate. Fifth, we need to demystify drones. Yes, they can be controlled from far away, and yes, they have weapons on them. They crash a lot, they're incredibly difficult to control, and they're actually very easy to shoot down. Part of why drones are being used, where they're being used, is because of the relatively weak military capability of those they are being used against, which should tell you something, therefore, about the scope of the threat that these people pose. Finally, there's a need to contest the notions of precision and control that are assumed within contemporary security discourses around war fighting. The study of war and the practices of war have always kind of operated on the assumption that you can control, or you should attempt to control as much as possible, what's going on, to deal with uncertainty. And there's this notion, particularly within military circles at this time, that you can control and predict and control the effects of targeted killing. That's absolute rubbish. Okay, human beings are very complex creatures. This notion that effects-based operations will produce the effects that you want is not always the case. If effects-based operations work, notions of doing kind of spectacular forms of violence in order to shape the behavior of populations, then this country would have crumbled under the Blitz. So we need to be challenging those who claim to speak on behalf of the military or for the military that somehow they know how all these things will play out in advance. They don't. Thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you, Kyle. I thought that was fantastic. I don't know about you, but those of you who are actually still studying, you've got a heck of a lot of information just to put into your essays there as well. And I felt rather quite sick knowing that there's all this targeted killing going on. I mean, are we in such a Big Brother world that it's just that, you know, that you can symbolise a dartboard and the red spot in the middle is just a dagger, you know? It's so controlled. But Kyle said they try to control, but in actual fact you can't, because yes, human beings are complex creatures. Also, thesis three as well kind of spooked me. It had the Illuminati eye, and yeah, again, that's that brings back to the point of that we're actually being seen by this, and it really is. It's a complex web of systems that is going on here amongst political parties, namely with the allies, so the US and its folks, Israel and so on. We've been kind of changed into that as well. But yeah, this is on the borderline of, as we say, it could potentially be World War III. And what does that mean? At this point in time, most countries now have nuclear weapons, so it can get, again, God forbid, pretty heavy. Even that, with the drone strikes and so on as well, it's interconnected. There's lots of things that's used as propaganda as well. So many points you can touch upon, even, for example, war on terror. Where did that come about from? Terror, you know, that's automatically, you've got a reason to annihilate a population on the basis of one thing, say if it's race or religion, because then that's the bit where it's population manipulation as well, kind of thing. There's always shuns in and isms in politics, but that's the way it is. But yeah, what are all your thoughts and opinions on this right now? We know we had Alex say as well before it's imperative and important that there's a resistance, because without our voices, there wouldn't be something that counteracts or is there to resist it, you know? It's like even with the cuts, if there were demos, people were actually trying to build this awareness of what's actually been going on, because it's trying to protect a monetary facility here. And what's that money? We're not going to take that to our graves, are we? It's people getting very sidetracked with what is the value in life as well. And what is that, you know? I came across this quote on Facebook. I'm going to share it with you. It's really good. It's basically, if one person is killed, it's murder. But if 100,000 are killed, it's foreign policy, and that's what it is. It seems like we're in nowadays as well. So what we're going to do now is liven this up. I'd like to get your thoughts and opinions about where we are. Where do you think we can actually take it as well to prevent this as well? So opening the floor to question and answer.